Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 9th of April. This hour of the program, we talk about what's become a standoff. An American warship early Thursday did reach the scene of this Somali pirate attack on the U.S. operated container ship. The ship was sending relief supplies to Kenya. We have the captain being held by the pirates, and the other crew members have been released, and it is a standoff. The ship's operator, Maersk Line, has said that the information it is receiving suggests the captain is unharmed. We are working, they say, with all involved government agencies, particularly the U.S. Navy, which has arrived on the scene, is taking the lead in working toward the captain's release. FBI hostage negotiators are assisting. This is a long line, really, of attacks that have taken place over the last year and also over the last few days in this part of the world by Somali pirates. We will be talking about those ships that are still being held, and there are a number of them, and people being held as well. Last year, private shipping companies paid roughly $150 million in ransom to pirates who used the money to fund fancy lifestyles and real estate investments in Nairobi, which is the capital of Kenya. Obviously, this is going to have to be worked out on land in addition to on sea. So we'll be talking about what's going on with the Somali government and why there are so many of these pretty unusual events for the year 2009. We have two guests with us, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our guests are joining us by phone today. We have Professor Jonathan Gluthoff with us, who is a professor of law at Roger Williams University and has written, he knows a great deal about the law of the sea and the law of piracy. He's also written a very interesting piece, The Law of Piracy in Popular Culture. And Professor Gluthoff, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah. Also joining us is Professor Ken Menkhaus. He's Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College and has spent some time in Somalia. He was Special Political Advisor for the Policy Planning Group UN Operation in Somalia from 1993 to 1994. Professor Menkhaus, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Let's just talk about the situation that exists as we speak. You've got this American warship there. You've got people in a boat along with the captain of the ship, and it's kind of floating because they've run out of fuel. And I imagine what's going on now is fairly intense negotiations. How would you advise these negotiations? Who's doing the negotiating? And is it likely that this captain will be released?
Well, in the past, negotiations have been fairly successful in delivering the crews up unharmed. As you mentioned, shipping companies and then eventually the insurers of the vessels and of the cargo aboard the vessels have had to pay well over $100 million in the last year, but the pirates really just have the interest in getting the money. And generally what will happen is, and I'm not sure if the Navy will agree to this, is they want all potentially hostile vessels to go back over the horizon out of sight. They'll then require that the money be generally dropped by helicopter and get to shore. I think the matter is complicated somewhat in this case. My understanding is the lifeboat in which the pirates and the captain are currently afloat is out of fuel. So the pirates really have no way of getting away, which I suppose is good. But on the other hand, I suppose it would complicate negotiations over the release of the captain.
Mm-hmm. If you were doing negotiating, Professor Menkhaus, what would you say?
It depends who I would be speaking for. I can tell you that the shipping companies would be very interested in, almost exclusively interested in getting the captain back and making this wrap up very quickly. The U.S. Navy may have slightly different agendas. They would be, of course, very concerned about the safety of the captain, but they also have interests in maintaining free shipping lanes in that part of the world in principle, and so they may be a little bit more inclined to try to use this to set an example, but I think everyone is going to be preoccupied with doing this very rapidly. I can also tell you, having been out with fishermen, Somali fishermen out in those seas in those very small boats, that if it's not moving, they're going to be very seasick.
Yeah, I would imagine. So who would be likely in this case to pay a ransom? The shipping company? I can't imagine the U.S. Navy would they?
No, it's the insurance companies that would pay it. And that makes it even more interesting because the insurance companies have a greater interest in prolonging the discussion to try to drive the price down, whereas the shipping company actually wants it wrapped up very quickly. So there's slightly divergent interest between those two actors.
Mm-hmm. Who are these pirates, Professor Gutov?
Professor Menkov has probably a much better idea than I do. My understanding is that they sort of fall into a couple of, or perhaps several different groups. One are the people who have some navigational experience. The other people who have ready access to small arms who might be taken out to use force. And the third are sort of, I suppose, there's some people who have some technical skill at both radar tracking and navigation. And getting these small boats out to sea is several hundred miles offshore is an interesting logistical feat, really. But my understanding is they have larger boats and taking smaller skiffs, which are then used to attack the cargo ships.
And tell me about what's going on an international level, a legal international level. I understand that the U.S. and other nations and some international bodies, the United Nations, the Arab League, the European Union, and NATO, are looking for ways to stop this kind of piracy off the coast of East Africa. Is there some international body that's looking over this? Is there some international body that deals with this legally?
Well, there's a quasi-international body called the International Maritime Organization that tracks piracy and certainly encourages international bodies like the United Nations to take action. The United Nations has authorized all nations who are capable of doing so to go into Somali territorial waters to combat piracy. And those patrols have been proceeding to the north in the Gulf of Aden. The problem is, as I think a spokesman for the Navy mentioned, the Navy can't be everywhere at once. Even the Navy of a whole lot of nations can't be everywhere in this huge stretch of land, given now the scope of operations. And international conventions, there are two in scope, the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, to which this country isn't a party, but we recognize as stating customary international law, obligates countries to resist piracy. And there's another convention called the Convention for Suppression of Unlawful Acts Against the Safety of Navigation, to which this country is a party. And this country takes a very broad view of that and certainly would have no problem apprehending, as a legal matter, people committing piracy anywhere in the world and bringing them to trial in the United States. The problem is, and this is why I'm very interested to hear what Professor Menkov has to say, is really much more of a political one. Somalia has an incredibly long coast that cannot be patrolled at great expense, probably a greater expense than $150 million a year, which is the maximum, I believe, that the pirates have received in ransom payments. And given the near impossibility of patrolling the coastline, the ultimate solution, I think, really has to be a landward one. That is,
yes,
getting a government in Somalia that is both able to and has the incentive to restrain these sort of forays coming out from this very, very lengthy coastline.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the current government in Somalia, Professor Menkov.
Well, there's three that we need to speak of. There is a transitional federal government that exists right now on paper, but it's really not operational in the capital. It has some promise, but it is not in any position to do anything about this. Then there is a regional government in the area where the piracy is most active, and that's called Puntland in the northeast corner of the country. And the problem there is that because piracy has been lucrative, I don't know that it's been $150 million lucrative. The figures that I have access to suggest that it's quite a bit lower, closer to $20 to $40 million in ransoms last year. But that's still a huge amount of money in a country whose number one export, livestock, only earns $100 million a year. And what's happened up in Puntland is that money has turned the entire government up there into essentially a pirate version of a narco state in which political and economic figures are very active in supporting the pirates, fronting the money for the equipment, getting a cut. And so, in terms of what Jonathan was saying, trying to find ways to incentivize local authorities to do something about it, that's been a problem in Puntland. There is a third authority, Somaliland in the northwest, a secessionist government that has a very strong interest in preventing piracy on its coast because it's trying very hard to convince the international community that we should recognize it. And one obvious way is to show that they can deliver the goods on things like anti-piracy. So no piracy has occurred on their shores.
Oh, my goodness. What a mess, huh? Wow. And tell me more about this transitional federal government. How is it transitional? What are they?
The transitional federal government is the latest iteration of a long series of peace conferences designed to bring a functional government to Somalia. Somalia is unique in that it's been without a functioning central government for 19 years.
Oh,
it's the longest-running instance of complete state collapse in the post-colonial era. This one was brokered in late 2004 in Kenya. It has been through one series of crises after another. I won't go into the long history, but it's included internal clashes, the rise of an Islamist counter-movement that took control of most of southern Somalia in 2006. The Ethiopians then invaded, ousted the Islamists, and occupied the country for 2 years. They're now out. The transitional federal government now has new leadership born of a recent accord that has been forged between moderates on the two factions in Somalia. And so there's some good people in this new government, and it has international support. It's promising, but it really just exists on paper for the moment. The country is still divided into quarreling fiefdoms, some controlled by hardline Islamists, some by moderate Islamists, some by clans, some by warlords, some by self-declared municipalities. It's a mosaic of local authorities and in between no small amount of anarchy.
Yes. It sounds like it will be virtually impossible to come up with a solution within the country concerning piracy, Professor Gutov. How are you going to do that when you've got this kind of jumbled mess?
I think it's very, very difficult just because of the way that the maritime world is currently organized. In the 18th century and the 19th century, the countries that took the lead in suppressing piracy were the countries with either large colonial interests and as well large maritime interests, huge merchant marine fleets. At this point, given the way the economy of the maritime world is organized, the countries with powerful navies on the whole tend not to have large merchant fleets like the United States, whereas the countries with large merchant fleets tend to be smaller countries or allow shipping interests to register their vessels pretty much all over the world, including landlocked countries such as Mongolia or Bolivia. And so you have this sort of disjunction of maritime interests and maritime force on the one hand, and secondly, the tools, I think, probably much for the better, that were used to suppress piracy in the 18th and 19th centuries were basically setting up quasi-sovereign areas of control in the areas infested by pirates, either as a colonial matter or just as an assertion of judicial authorities used to suppress the piracy. This was used by the British in suppression of piracy in the Mediterranean in the 1820s, arising out of the Greek Civil War. This country is not in a position to do that either as a matter of the current international order, fortunately, and as a matter of economics. So there really has to be some form of international cooperation to do this. The legal mechanisms for any individual country to suppress piracy are certainly extant under both customary international law and conventions to which countries are parties. But how that political cooperation is to be attained, I'm really at a loss. I think it's if it's not an intractable problem, it's one to which I don't have a ready solution.
Right. And they used to hang a lot of pirates, didn't they?
Well, yeah, this is something that's received a lot of popular press.
Right.
The piracy trials, certainly that the British conducted in the 18th and 19th centuries, looked very much like then-contemporary criminal trials. So, yeah, while a lot of people who were convicted were put to death, there were a lot of acquittals. This wasn't a case of totally summary process without any protections to the defendant. So they and again, the problem isn't how to try them, which I think is and this I really defer to Professor Menkes. The legal mechanisms are really a secondary or tertiary part of the solution to the problem. The problem is getting people who, nations or international organizations who are willing to commit the resources to intensely patrolling the area, to setting up some form of criminal enforcement on the landward side of Somalia, and bring the people to trial either in Somalia or elsewhere, which has been a problem, understandably something that a lot of countries aren't readily willing to do.
Right.
And there was a case of a Danish vessel that captured some pirates, and the commander of the vessel was at such a loss with what to do with them, he simply disarmed them and let them go on shore in Somalia for want of anything to do. About to take them back to Denmark.
Let me ask Professor Menkes one more question, then we'll go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Just a couple more questions for you, Professor Menkes. It seems to me as though some of these pirates look like they're 16 years old when they're on the television. They look very, very young. In some ways, I'm sure that they are thought of as brave young guys to do this, to go hundreds of miles out to sea in a little boat and then climb these huge vessels is incredible, isn't it?
Actually, it's a lot lower risk than you might think.
Really?
Because they're taking the you're right that they are young gunmen. And they're looking to make their fortune. You know, they'll get a decent cut. They don't get all of this money by any means, but they'll get a cut of the money once it's delivered. And what they're doing is joining the small pirate cells of typically teams of seven or eight. And as Jonathan said, there's almost always one ex-Coast Guard or someone with some additional shipping skills and communication skills. But the rest of them are just kids with guns, AK-47s and rocket-propelled grenades. The small skiffs that they're on will typically hijack a fishing vessel or a dhow near shore. So they're not taking these small boats way, way out into the Indian Ocean or the Gulf of Aden. They'll use those as so-called motherships to approach a cargo ship. They look innocuous as a result, and then it's really only 15 minutes ship to ship. They typically choose slow, low cargo ships that are easy to climb with grappling hooks and ladders, and they almost never face resistance because the crew is unarmed and has no interest in it's very risky for them to try to resist, particularly because the pirates are shooting on the ship to try to discourage them from going away. So the success rate is relatively high. It used to be as high as 50%. Now the figures are lower because ships are taking more evasive maneuvers and there are the patrols, but it's still relatively high success rate. Very few pirates have died. There have been some who drowned when their skiffs have capsized, and a couple have been hit by the naval patrols. But generally, it's still pretty low risk. So, are they seen as heroes by the Somalis? That's a whole other question. The Somali narrative on the entire piracy epidemic is entirely different from ours. Of course, many Somalis do recognize that this is a criminal act, that this is yet another blight on the reputation of the country. It just reinforces global stereotypes about Somalia as a hopeless mess and a site of anarchy and criminality. But the dominant discourse among Somalis is that the pirates are essentially their coast guard protecting their coast from illegal fishing. And that's the obsession that Somalis have. They are right. There has been a lot of illegal fishing of their shores. It does not in any way justify going after cargo ships right. that are hundreds of kilometers away. But that, you know, that's their narrative, and they're sticking to it. They are also very unhappy with what they see as a very expensive, robust international response to the piracy, but a level of global indifference to the enormous humanitarian crisis going on in Somalia right now. Just to put the figures all in perspective, the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is calling for $950 million of emergency aid because 3.2 million Somalis are in a state of emergency need for food. They're one step away from famine. It's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world.
No.
They're not able to generate much response for that, but the world is able to patrol, you know, to devote 24 warships to patrol the shores to prevent $20 to $40 million or maybe more of ransom per year. And so the Somalis see all of this in a very different light.
So this particular ship that had relief supplies had food on it. Is a different case that they were getting this for food, or it didn't matter?
Oh, they don't particularly care what the ships. They don't know what the ships are carrying.
I see.
They've caught oil tankers. They've caught ships that had used tanks on them that caused a big stir. They've what they get is what they find out when they're on board. They're not interested in stealing the food aid or whatever else is on there. They're simply interested in the ransom. So they would argue, look, we're not stopping the shipments of food aid from arriving into East Africa. We're simply getting, you know, this is part of an economy. And the fact is, it's really, it's just part of an economy now that a lot of Somalis are benefiting from, including some Somalis who live abroad. There are going to be some Somali diaspora members, even here in the United States, who we have good reason to believe have contributed to some of the financing of these pirate groups and then get a cut.
Oh my. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our lines are pretty busy, but keep the number in mind, 800-486-8655. Professor Ken Menkhouse, Associate Professor of Political Science at Davidson College, who spent time in Somalia as a special political advisor for UN operations in Somalia in the 90s. Professor Jonathan Gutoff is with us, professor of law at Roger Williams University, and knows a great deal about the history of piracy and legal response to that internationally over centuries. To you in a moment, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And let's start our calls with Tom from Loyal. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Kathleen. Interesting discussion. Since the government, or since there isn't a government in Somalia, I was wondering if, and I know there are different flagships for different countries, but would they be able to put together a convoy with a military escort so that these ships wouldn't be going out by themselves? Because from what I've seen on television, these ships are very easy to capture by themselves.
Is that question directed to me?
Yes, go right ahead,
sure.
Professor Gutoff.
I think that one of the problems with a convoy system, in addition to trying to figure out who would pay for it, is the way that modern shipping works. It's not, modern shipping is much like modern trucking. That is, vessels are constantly going out and leaving, trying to make just-in-time deliveries. And I think both the owners of the cargo and the owners of the vessels would take a lot of cajoling to be able to, you know, assemble convoys, just given the whole sort of diverse nature of the maritime economy. This, in World War II, you know, we were able to organize convoys across the Atlantic, or the British were, because we controlled all the merchant ships coming and going. They were all American or British flagged, coming and going to Northern Europe at the time. Now, I think would be a very, very difficult thing to organize a convoy system.
All right, thank
could
you.
Could I jump in on that?
Yes,
one?
Yes, please.
Yeah, because we do have a convoy system operating now. There are several different essentially coalitions. That's not the right word of navies that have come together to try to address this. We've got up to over 20 countries now have dedicated naval patrols in either the Gulf of Aden or the Indian Ocean. It's a fascinating combination of countries. We've got Russia and China and Iran and the United States, and I mean it's an interesting set of bedfellows. There is a contact group that has been established to coordinate all of this, and there is a convoy in the Gulf of Aden. This is the northern, you know, the area that leads into the Red Sea for the 20,000 or so ships per year that go through the Suez Canal. Even there, Jonathan is correct. It's very difficult. It's expensive for the ships to wait for these convoys, and they have still been picked off in the convoys because the ships are very far apart, and it does not take much time to grab one. The problem in the Indian Ocean is that we're talking about a sea that is just incredibly vast. The piracy has occurred in an area of 2.5 million square miles, and there is just no way that they can patrol or establish convoys for that much traffic over that much space.
Right.
So the convoys are helping a little bit. They're slowing down the success rate, but they're not going to end it. This is going to have to be an onshore solution.
Do either of you, I keep reading conflicting news stories here. I think that many of us were not aware that there are a lot of ships still being held and a lot of people being held waiting for ransom. Do either of you have a clear handle on how many?
Yes. There's currently 14 ships being held and roughly 150 or so hostages that are being held. Again, this goes back to the negotiations. The pirates have all the time in the world at this point. The insurance company is eager to try to drive the price down, and so we'll engage in. They'll take their time. The shipping company, of course, wants their crew back, and they want their ship back every day. They don't have the ship; they're losing money. But these negotiations can go on for upward of a month. Or even two. The crews are generally well taken care of. They stay on ship. There's whole catering businesses in these little villages now that have sprung up to provide food and water for them. But that is standard. And I've had a chance to talk with some executives from some of the shipping companies, and their preoccupation is to let the current situation, while it's not good, is manageable. They would rather pay the ransom, which is essentially a nuisance tax for operating in that part of the world. It's not that much money. Insurance rates are not going up very much in that area, rather than the risk of an operation to try to take them out.
And we welcome more phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm just having a problem with my earphones, so excuse me for a moment while I try to get this fixed. Let's go to Bob from Wauwatosa next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. This is a fascinating discussion, but I have a possible solution, and I'm frankly perplexed as to why some of the ship owners haven't thought of it and or acted on it. You know, given the value of the vessels and the value of their cargoes and the expense incurred by having these vessels out of commission for months at a time when they're hijacked, why aren't these ship owners hiring ex-Army and Marine personnel familiar with the use of the 50 caliber machine gun and helicoptering these people out from South Africa as the ships round the Horn of Africa? And there could be a similar helicoptering point over towards the Gulf of Aden. Why aren't they helicoptering personnel with their 50 caliber machine guns onto the decks of these ships and keeping them on board for the appropriate length of time and in the appropriate waters? That's a relatively inexpensive weapon, and it seems to me to be a low-tech solution. Why isn't anybody doing this?
I can answer that, again, having spoken with executives from some of the shipping companies. They are very opposed to doing this.
Why?
First of all, it's not inexpensive. It adds to the cost, and as Jonathan put it, they're working on razor-thin profit margins now, especially with the economy down. The liability of having armed individuals on the ships is very high. There is also the prospect of, with the amount of money at stake, once you've got someone who's armed on the ship colluding with the pirates, there have been cases of that in the past. I don't know if it's been off the coast of Somalia, but that adds to the problems. And they don't want shootouts with the pirates. Again, their perspective is the amount of money that they're having to pay in ransom right now, and the statistical odds on one of their ships being captured is quite low. It's a nuisance. They're quite opposed to the idea, and they can't go into ports with weapons. There's a whole additional dimension to that, which is, you know, why I suppose you're proposing the helicopter solution so that they're never actually in or out of a foreign port with arms.
Yeah, I just like to throw in that the potential legal liabilities, I think, are something that the insurance companies are very wary of too. That is, whereas generally national ships of war are immune from prosecution and seizure by other countries under international law. If, for instance, one of the armed guards on a private vessel was to accidentally shoot a innocent fishing skiff that he had mistaken for a pirate, that vessel would be liable to seizure. Whether the prosecution of the crew would be a possibility for violence on the high seas, but the last thing you would want to, if you were an insurer or a vessel owner, is to have your ship seized for prosecution, say by the Nigerian Navy in retaliation, and justifiably for the accidental shooting of a Nigerian fisherman. And there have been cases, in fact, where even national navies have accidentally shot at the wrong boat. So I think I think for all the reasons Professor Menkow said, and for potential legal liability, it's not something anybody is willing to risk. Hello?
Hello, I can hear you.
Oh, okay.
I presume we're on air. We've lost everyone else, though. Okay, if anyone out there can hear me, I'm going to hang up, and hopefully you'll call me back and get me back on air.
I'll be here at the same number, too. Okay. I look forward to joining you soon.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm sorry, we're having some profound technical difficulties here in our studios. So stay with us. We're going to try and resume our conversation and get our guests back, but our phone should be working as well. Thanks, everybody. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'm sorry we have lost we lost all audio for about 10 minutes here, so it was a very strange situation that I have never experienced before in radio, where I could not hear the guests, and I knew they were talking, so I don't know what they were saying, but I think that you heard what they were saying, and now we're trying to get them back and continue our conversation about what's been going on with this American crew and the captain who's being held off the coast of Somalia, several hundred miles over off the coast of Somalia. We do have Professor Gutoff with us again, professor of law at Roger Williams University, and Professor Ken Menkhaus will also be joining us again as soon as we get him on the line, associate professor of political science at Davidson College. So we're just trying to reach him. Call back, everybody. I know we had a full bank of phone lines. I hope you stayed with us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. for you to join our conversation. Professor Gudoff, hello again.
Hi.
I don't know what you guys were saying because I couldn't hear a thing. It was absolutely bizarre. But we'll take more phone calls, and I believe that we're going to have Professor Minkhaus with us as well. Just your thoughts about the best way at this point, and you have this historical perspective on the issue, to handle what's happening right now. Are you worried about the well-being of this captain? There hasn't been a history of violence with these particular pirates. Has there been a history of violence over the hundreds of years that we've had pirates? Is there something we can learn from history about how to negotiate here?
Yeah, the history of violence among pirates has varied depending on the purpose of the capture. At certain points in the 18th century, there's been a lot of literature about how certain aspects of piracy then were seen as vengeance against the oppression of common seamen, and occasionally there'd be violence against officers of ships that were seized. Furthermore, when ships were seized as some part of war or quasi war, there was often a good deal of violence associated with this. But traditionally, piracy has looked a lot like it looks now, either involving the theft of cargo, which is generally a sort of low-level operation, and you see this in all parts of the world, people breaking into the containers on board vessels and stealing whatever might be available, and the taking of hostages, which is something that coastal communities, seeing vessels going by, carrying a lot more wealth than the coastal communities might have been tempted to do since some early historical times. So there's Greek mythology about how the god Dionysus was taken captive by pirates off the coast of what's now Asia Minor. So it's a very long-standing problem. And so where you have a place like Somalia where they're readily available small arms, machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades, close to probably a third of the world's wealth sailing back and forth off the coast, it is going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only two ways to deal with it are, one, just to incorporate it as a cost of doing business for the shipping companies, or, as Professor Minkhaus was discussing, coming to some sort of shoreside solution with the establishment of a stable government able and with the interest in enforcing laws on the coast, because the naval resources that various maritime nations of the world are able to devote towards the patrolling of the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean simply are not sufficient to adequately prevent attacks on the huge amount of shipping that goes back and forth across the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm. Professor Minkhaus, I want to talk about the money just a little bit more here. You mentioned that these pirates get a cut of the money and that a regional government would get a cut of the money. Where else is the money going?
We'll make demands. Other pirates will insist on contributing to security to get a cut. Local authorities will get a cut. Business people who have been the financial backers will get a cut. The money spreads pretty widely, and that's one of the reasons why there isn't a whole lot of incentive on the part of the local communities to combat the piracy, because it is a livelihood for a lot of people. That's one of the reasons why an onshore solution is going to be a long, difficult process. When it happens, it's going to happen because a political authority is going to see that ending piracy is going to be a critically important gesture on their part to earn international legitimacy.
Mm-hmm. And is there something that, I know you've worked with the UN, is there something the UN can do to help help achieve some kind of stability in this country and a will to take on this problem, or the United States, or I don't know, somebody needs to do something, it seems to me.
Well, they are. The UN has been very active, and donor states like the United States and others have been very active in supporting the peace process, this transitional federal government. They're doing the best they can. It has been the political situation inside Somalia is a whole other story, and it's unbelievably complicated. To the extent that it's going to take a long time before we have a functional government in Somalia, and frankly, their number one priority is not going to be piracy. They've got a lot of much bigger problems to deal with on shore.
Right. We had a couple people before we had some technical problems here ask, why is it that these ships cannot be armed? Are there laws, rules against that, Professor Gutov?
Professor Menkaus was indicating that it's difficult and generally impossible to bring heavily armed private ships into the port of any world. As far as arming them, one of the callers that I heard, I don't know if anyone heard either of Professor Menkaus's response or my response.
Yeah, they heard you. I just couldn't. Everybody heard you guys. I couldn't hear you.
That, you know, these people be helicoptered out of the vessels in the Indian Ocean. What's now, I believe, called Z Corporation, which was the former Blackwater, has a vessel that it's been trying to convince people to use for those purposes, this helicopter capability. It hasn't found any buyers. One, just because of no one wants their crew to be on a vessel that's being involved in a firefight. And two, I think the potential legal liabilities for mistakenly shooting a fishing skiff that really just is a fishing skiff, that isn't a potential pirate vessel, are really catastrophic. It would potentially involve the vessel being damned by any Navy who wants to enforce the law. Private vessels are not immune from seizure by law enforcement authorities, unlike naval vessels. So I think it's something that, there's been some interest in, sort of security companies in providing these services, but my understanding is that both insurance companies and shipping companies are not interested in buying those services.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just add, in terms of the cost-benefit analysis that goes into all of this, and this is all, shipping is, like any industry, very much bottom line. I mean, they have obviously done the math on this, and for them, it is much more costly, potentially, to have to deal with the legal liability of being armed than it is to have to pay occasionally to get their ships and crews back from pirates. But having said that, there are some potential game changers in all of this, and that's what just happened yesterday. When you have a U.S. flagged ship and U.S. crew, that changes everything. Now the U.S. Navy is going to be a much more alert to interdiction. There is the potential now of an additional cost to the shipping company, and that is the potential of lawsuits from the crew themselves. If they are held for a long period of time, they could sue. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't get into the details on that, but I'm assured that that is a case that could occur. Then the costs get driven up, and then they might recalculate their options.
Let's go to Leo. We can take calls again, everybody. 800-486-8655, but call soon because we're running out of time. Leo from Washington Island. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. First, I'd like to give prayer and praise to the captain of that ship and to the crew, who is probably members of Seafarers International Union, who are well-trained probably in this situation. Most of this happens because Congress acts so slow with the Maritime Administration, and our maritime really is the backbone for our military. But there are situations and things that the government, that our government can do for these shipping companies who pay a lot of money. Number one, they could establish a military escort. Now, the military is probably just sitting back and they're watching everything that's going on. But now it has escalated from just going on these ships and robbing the cash that these captains carry. With ships that travels the world, have to have an amount of cash on board for pay the crew and for repairs. But now it goes to where they want to hold crews hostages. And the Somalis, they have escalated this ordeal on boarding these ships and taking hostage because they're not afraid of the United States anymore because of certain international laws. And to the fact that these ships are not armed, well, my knowing from being a merchant marine, I'm retired now, that the captain and the chief mate do have small arms. But due to international laws, you know, you're not, like one guy said, you know, if you shoot someone or something like that, you know, then you're liable. But there's other precautionary that the ships could take, such as upscaling their watches, have more people on watch. Their only arm would be maybe water holes, you know. And this has been an ongoing problem for years in the maritime system.
Did you ever encounter this problem, Leo, when you were on the seas?
During the Gulf War, we left Singapore and headed through the Philippines, and we had an encounter in the Straits of Philippines.
Hmm.
And they come out at night, and they have these fast boats, and they use grappling hooks, and they come aboard. Well, what our captain did, we knew ahead of time that we was going in this area. So he established extra watches. And this is what they need to do. But I give thanks and praise to Seafarers International Union for having trained our seamen.
Okay. Professor Gutov, you want to start with the response?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really disagree with anything was said. I think, you know, one of the problems of, you know, getting a concentrated response, to some extent a response to Professor Menkov's observation, which I think is right on point, that obviously, you know, the United States is going to respond quite rapidly when there's U.S. interests at stake, when U.S. sailors at stake, U.S. Chartered vessels at stake, just as Russia did when a cargo of their used tanks were seized last fall. One of the problems, if it's a problem at all, is that there are very few U.S. ships crewed by U.S. sailors sailing the high seas now. And much of the merchant fleet comes out of, you know, East Asia or Southeast Asia. And you do see, you know, the Indian Navy and the Chinese Navy participating in these patrols, but I think you would see a much stronger response if there were more actual U.S. seamen and U.S. vessels at risk. And there just really aren't that many U.S. vessels and U.S. seamen, merchant seamen, flying the high seas right now.
In this incident, we'll watch carefully, as Professor Menkow said, what's going on now is a potential game changer, which is interesting. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm sorry we had problems here, but it was really an interesting hour. Thank you so much for being with us. Our thanks to Professor Gutov, Professor of Law at Roger Williams University, Professor Menkow from Davidson College, Professor of Political Science. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this highly interesting show, and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll return with another hour following the news.